Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. On his way out of office in 1961, President Eisenhower warned of the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry, and its growing influence on America's economic, political, and even spiritual life. Fast forward to the year 2001, and what Eisenhower had termed the military-industrial complex has been extended at least a quantum leap by computers and networked media. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the implications of what our guest calls the military-industrial media entertainment network, how virtual technology is changing the nature of war and perhaps the nature of peace as well. Our guest is the writer and scholar James Derderian. He is a research professor of international relations and principal investigator of the Virtual War and Diplomacy Project at the University of Massachusetts Watson Institute. He also teaches at Brown University. He's a visiting scholar at Harvard, MIT, Oxford, and the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University, among other places, and has been published in a number of scholarly journals on international relations. His articles on war and technology have also appeared in Wired magazine, The Washington Quarterly, and The Nation, and he's the author of a very interesting new book we'll be discussing during this hour. It is entitled Virtuous War, Mapping the Military-Industrial Media Entertainment Network, recently published by Westview Press. In the book, James Derderian chronicles his travels to the frontiers of the virtual military and poses a number of critical questions about how it may change our perceptions of war and peace in the coming decades. We'll talk about that during this hour. As we do so, your questions and observations are welcomed. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call around Champaign-Urbana is simply 333-WILL. That's 333-9455, if that makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, calls are welcome at 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Professor Derderian, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Very interesting book.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you to begin. Maybe you could explain what you mean by the title, Virtuous War, and the virtual revolution you describe in the book.
Well, it's really a combination of the idea of the virtual in the sense of something that produces an effect at a distance. Often we think about it in terms of digital effects, how you can have a digital actor or a virtual environment, for instance. But it's also combining it with the idea, of course, of virtue, the sense that there is a new ethical imperative for the United States foreign policy. And we certainly saw that at its peak in the Clinton administration, but we're also seeing it somewhat in from the other side of the political spectrum under President Bush, the idea that America can do good and must do good with its technological advance and advantage in its military power.
So part of it is technological and the other part is essentially a matter of values?
Yes, it's sort of this ethical, technical imperative that I think is driving, in many ways, in an unselfconscious way, our military and foreign policy at the moment.
This is a major shift from thinking about the role of the military in the past?
Well, some people see a vacillation or an oscillation between a realist foreign policy, you see things as they really are, meaning everything's in terms of power,
yeah,
and the idealist. Sometimes it's also cast as the Wilsonian or the Roosevelt vision of American foreign policy, or the Machiavellian versus the Kantian one, if we want to be citing philosophers. But it really boils down to the idea that the long history of the United States' involvement or non-involvement in the world, when it was more isolationist, has been between these two poles of do you try to do good and be active and try to make the world as you would want it to be, or is it more accepted as it is and morals play a very slim, if any, role at all?
And the military has traditionally been a very realist kind of organization. In the sort of the previous decades, the way it's been deployed, although I think that, you know, as you mentioned, there has been some oscillation in the views of these, you know, these issues in recent years, where we've gone to places like, you know, Haiti and Bosnia and so forth. Is this an example of the kind of thing you mean in terms of the virtuous use of the military?
Very much so. And there's far from any unanimity within the military on this issue. You know, the so-called mud soldiers or the pragmatists don't want to see, you know, U.S. troops turned into policemen or, you know, God forbid, into civilian administrators, as some see their role in Kosovo or in Bosnia. But there are others who see that, the United States is a world power, if not the most, you know, a unipolar power at the moment when it comes to military might. And therefore, it's going to be called upon. Some call, you know, say it's the 9/11, you know, the emergency call whenever something goes wrong or there's a looming genocide. Without the U.S. ability, particularly its lift ability, its ability to project force at a distance, and that at a distance is part of this sort of idea of virtuality, is what gives it this sort of special role now in, you know, this new century.
Well, also the fact that the Cold War ended, and there's been quite a bit of, you know, wondering, like, you know, well, does the United States have any enemies? You know, what is this? What is the new paradigm or the role for the U.S. military if not in opposition to some defined entity?
Yeah, that's a key issue. When Powell was the Joint Chiefs of Staff, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said, you know, all I've got is enemies left is Castro and, you know, maybe the president of North Korea. And the absence of a real sort of an enemy of a peer level, it's more difficult to find coherence in your foreign policy. It's more difficult, of course, to get Congress to provide funding. So in some ways, the virtuality is also is sort of direct our attention to the extent to which in the preparation for war, we help create these virtual enemies. You know, are they real enemies or are they ones that sort of serve a purpose, be it for budgetary reasons, ideological reasons? And that's, I think, a critical issue given the sort of state of flux of the current world situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to come back to that issue, but just to sort of map out the topic a little bit more, can you talk about the ways in which technology are playing into this sort of new conception of the role and purpose and construction of the military? How does network technology, computers, digital simulation, and so forth play into this?
Oh, at all levels. I mean, we all got a glimpse of this during the Gulf War. Some people see it as the last industrial war, in the sense you had a massive, heavy armor, long build-up, big logistical tail. But at the same time, you had like a postmodern or some people call it cyber war, the idea you were fighting for the first time a war in which you had nearly total surveillance of the battlefield. You were using new computer technologies that were networked for targeting. You had, of course, a war that was being fought and in the same way it was being represented, meaning you had video cameras in the nose cones of smart bombs that then would be used for the briefing that very day. To show that, you know, every bomb seemed to be hitting its target, which we know after the fact wasn't true. But nonetheless, that first impression was of, you know, technology works, and it gave us this advantage that created an incredible victory in one sense on the battlefield, but certainly not, you know, in the political front, because after all, Saddam Hussein is still in power. But it did as well create these sort of skewed casualty rates. That's one of the, I think, the aspects of virtuous war we have to really focus on. The technological edge means that one side, driven as well by the Vietnam syndrome, as it's been called, where American boys aren't going to ever come home in body bags in large numbers again, it means that you have like high casualty rates on the other side. You know, if you don't have the technological advantage and you can't find a way to fight asymmetrical wars, you have these skewed casualty rates. You know, in the Gulf War, is like 270-odd, you know, Americans, many of them killed by accident or friendly fire. And God knows how many Iraqis, you know, the numbers are still in dispute. And in each war or conflict that America has been involved in since then, you know, including Mogadishu, Bosnia, Kosovo, you know, we see a decline in American casualties until we had this sort of remarkable casualty-free, zero casualty air campaign in the case of Kosovo.
Yeah, that is rather remarkable. In some ways, it seems that the Gulf War was a prelude to the Kosovo air campaign.
Yes, in many ways. There were even greater technological leaps, with global positioning systems now installed in these smart bombs. It makes them even more lethal, but yet you can still have accidents. You can have a bomb not miss, but actually hit its designated target, and yet the people who put that little X on the map failed to recognize that the Chinese embassy had moved.
Right.
There were other accidents. In fact, the casualties of the Apache pilots is a case in point. So one of my points I make in the book is that, to be sure, technology might reduce casualties in outright combat, but it also increases the likelihood of these accidents, because when you network everything, you create cascading effects or higher complexities that makes it more difficult in many ways to manage war, even while you think, because of this technological advantage, that you are controlling your environment.
There's another thread that I want to pursue, but first let me ask, you've talked with a large number of the people who are leading this effort within the military. How do they think and talk about it?
Sometimes it's almost like listening to a Star Trek episode. It's like this, they'll be spouting acronyms and talking about virtual environments that make you think of, the holodeck on, Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Sure.
It's all going to be this, controlled environment. And, of course, we know war is full of fog and friction and all these other things that Clausewitz told us about. But some of them, they're very smart, well-trained, in some ways idealistic, and they are well-intentioned. But my point is that there's unintended consequences in spite of your good intentions. When you have people like the Vice Admiral Saprowski, who's the president of the Naval War College, is one of the people who's been promoting network-centric warfare. I interview him, and, he's a true believer. But yet there's like various moments where this technology has failed, and if you create these networks that are supposed to run faster than human deliberation time, does it mean we're sort of giving up some of our own control and giving it to the machines themselves? And then there's people like, for instance, the current advisor, who's been around for a very long time, to Rumsfeld, the director of net assessments in the Pentagon. His name's Andrew Marshall. You might have heard that name. He's one of the longest-serving civilians in the Pentagon. And his idea is that we're in a revolution of military affairs, that we're in a situation similar to the period between the wars, the First World War and the Second World War. And we have to have the technological advantage that the British missed out on, or else, some new Germany will arise and take advantage of us.
This is the rhetoric that to me is very interesting. The people who are implementing this in the military describe it very much as a revolution, that this is not just, moving from propeller airplanes to jets, although that might have been something of a revolution as well, but more akin to, moving from, pre-flight to, jet flight or something.
Oh, very much so. Like even, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld loves to, when people like criticize, ballistic missile defense, that it hasn't worked and it's not likely to work anytime soon. He says, well, with that attitude, Orville would have never gotten in his airplane. These things are going to crash. This is an experiment. But there's a big difference when one individual airplane crashes and when, a $60 billion program crashes. Very different effects in terms of deterrence and how you're destabilizing an arms control regime. So there's no real clear analogies when people talk about, revolutions of the past, I think. It has to be the whole sort of zeitgeist of the, when you bring together not only new technologies of weapons, but also new ways of thinking that are required to use these weapons, what it means also for like civilian control of the military. After all, Germany putting together the airplane, the tank, the radio in a revolutionary way called the Blitzkrieg was a very much sort of improv. It wasn't sort of thought out clearly beforehand. It was almost after the fact that they sort of realized that they hit upon this revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing that seems revolutionary about it is that it's so pervasive. It doesn't just exist within the military. We're talking about technology, computers, networks, packet switched, you know, communication modes that exist really now throughout the economy.
Yeah, that is, I think, the qualitative difference from previous revolutions, that you have, you know, the way you do business and the way you do war and the way we perform in culture. They're now all, you know, working on this digital environment. And as well, the most important difference is that you can now reproduce reality in a way that you never could before. I don't know if you saw the article recently in the Times about how, you know, actors in Hollywood are getting worried about the ability now to reproduce them in such a sort of realistic fashion that maybe you won't even need humans in future movies. Well, similarly, this is sort of an issue, you know, in the military. What if you don't need humans in the next war? What does that mean?
We're talking this morning with James Derderian. His last name, by the way, is D-E-R-D-E-R-I-A-N. And we're talking about his book, Virtuous War, Mapping the Military-Industrial Media Entertainment Network. We sort of scratched the surface thus far, and we'll continue on. We have a couple of callers waiting. I'll get right to, and I'll mention the phone numbers again if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a couple of listeners. We'll go first to someone in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Thank you. You know, despite whatever rhetoric is used to dress it up and justify it, I would contend that the military's real purpose has all along been and continues to be, and especially if you look at people like Donald Rumsfeld, to further the economic interest of the ruling, you know, wealthy classes in the United States. And I find very little virtue in that.
Well, do you have
okay. That's certainly Eisenhower, the person who I'm obviously riffing off of when I use this military-industrial media entertainment network, was thought similarly that there were strong economic interests at work. But I'm trying to sort of broaden sort of the circle of, how to put it, like of causation. I don't think we can reduce it to strictly economic interest. There are some good-intentioned people in government, and there are also some people who, you know, genuinely think that the security of the United States will be furthered by this revolution in military affairs. I'm more interested in what they're not looking at and what they're not understanding in terms of cascading effects or unintended consequences or how the technology develops its own inertia. I don't think people are quite so, in one level sort of conspiratorial or always sort of following their material interest. It's a combination of interest at work, and that's why I have these sort of hyphenated, if not like Hydra-like forces at work to lend some complexity to the explanation of how we've reached this position of where we have these incredible defense budgets that that just don't seem to sort of correspond to what the real interest and real security needs are of the United States at the moment.
Well, I don't find that the military, which of course is run by the, you know, politicians who are run pretty much certainly at the presidential level by you know, the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules, really has, you know, the interest of the general public at heart, but is really looking out to protect, you know, the interest of the people who run the corporations.
It is interesting what Eisenhower left out of his 1961 farewell address when he talked about a military-industrial complex. It originally hid in the speech. He had military-industrial-congressional complex.
Right.
He wanted to emphasize that very point, that mm-hmm. you know, Congress wants to protect bases, and now you know both the defense industry and the military is quite savvy about this, that you know, if you build a B-1 bomber, you can be sure that every single state has produced some part of that bomber so that they all feel there's an interest in keeping that production line going. You know, and this is across the Democrats and the Republican lines. I mean, you know, Senator Lieberman wanted to keep, you know, the helicopters in the air and sell them to Colombian anti-terrorist groups, as they're called, because, you know, those helicopters are made in Connecticut, and Trent Lott wants ships to be, you know, made down as Louisiana shipyards.
Well, and certainly, you know, just sort of following the thread of the caller, you know, if one wanted to look for sort of a collusion to, you know, maintain, you know, power in the hands of the wealthy. It, you know, just the phrase, the military-industrial media entertainment network, when you look at the ownership of a lot of the defense companies sort of merging with the ownership of the media companies and how that essentially is in fewer and fewer hands, you know, there's plenty to get paranoid about.
Yeah, I guess so. It's the old line from Woody Allen that, yeah, if you're not paranoid, then you're crazy.
Right, exactly.
My point is that there are, first of all, not unified interests operating within that complex network. They can be at odds. And secondly, that there's often irrationalities that you know, everybody thinks, you know, it's very easy to discern what is my economic interest. But if you do a good microeconomic analysis, you can often find irrational outcomes. People don't always follow the rational choice in these matters. And I think the defense budget is a case in point.
One does have to ask, though, and I promise I'll get right to this next caller in just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Given that, you know, the technology we're talking about, digital network technology that can, as you mentioned, broadcast the view from the nose of the bomb as it finds its target, and that can be on CNN within literally minutes of the event, and where wars are televised to such an extent that, you know, it's kind of hard to keep up faster and faster. With the corporate connections between, you know, General Electric and, you know, the media television industry as well, and, you know, throughout the corporate complex that is involved in deploying the technology within the military, if there isn't some, whether intentional or not, coalescing of interest that sort of drives the process.
Yes. I would put the focus less, you know, I think everybody's fairly attuned to the military-industrial complex now. What I'm trying to show is how, for instance, I had like almost complete access to war games. This is sort of, this book is a travel log to going to various war games throughout the United States and in Europe and seeing if this stuff works. But the toughest time I had getting in any headquarters was Disney. You know, talk about secrecy and surveillance and impediments to open access. I was down in Orlando doing some work on the simulation industry, which is based around Orlando. And I can tell you, I had a lot better access to STRICOM, the main place where the military does its simulation training, than I could at Disney World, to the executives or the head office.
Well, another thread we'll follow up on. I want to include our caller here who's been waiting patiently next. This is someone in Champaign County, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I share the point of view of the previous caller. I think that when you get down to it and it's changed and it's interesting to hear it described, the complexities, but it does go back to a lot of greed and the people that identify their interests as the natural interests. Like, I'm sure Rumsfeld thinks that the health of his previous company and the companies he deals with is the health of the nation, and that's what he's worried about. But I don't see a lot of utility in this play on words that is like, looks like fundamental. Maybe it's just an accident of virtuality and virtuous, except it does allow me to say that I think the idea of a virtuous war conducted by the Pentagon is a virtuality. That is, it doesn't really exist. What we have on the ground is, you know, in the latest figures I've heard are about Iraq, which I guess was sort of virtual, is that from the depleted uranium munitions, something like 55 tons of that is in a soluble form after its use. Some of it's actually supposedly coming back to us because the scrap iron on the highway of death is the metal is melted down and shipped to factories across the United States. So there's a little bit of uranium-238 in some bumpers in Marion, Illinois, which is pretty astonishing. I don't know. I don't see a lot of point in the virtuous kind of play. The other thing I wanted to say is Rumsfeld is the big Space Command guy, and if you go to the U.S. Space Command, peterson.af for Air Force, .mil for military site, and look at their propaganda about the uses of space, you know, it is the war fighter's edge. They have a huge PDF file that just glamorously displays the capacities that we're striving for, and the generals like General Dynamic and General Electric are, greedily rubbing their hands together, thinking about all the money they're going to make. That's all I got for now, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Several good points. You know, it'd take a whole show to address all of them, but let me just take the first, the sort of the intentional ambiguity of a virtuous war. Obviously, I'm not saying that, you know, every time the military goes abroad, it's behaving virtuously. The issue here is that it's often being called upon to do so, which is often against its, you know, its training, its brief. You know, these are guys who trained to be combat soldiers, and this predates General Bush and, I'm sorry, Secretary of the Defense Rumsfeld and President Bush, or it really goes back as well to the, you know, the Clinton administration, the idea that sending troops into Bosnia and to Kosovo, you know, whatever your politics, if you're facing a genocide, for instance, if there's another brewing genocide in Rwanda or elsewhere, should American troops be dispatched? Because we're the only ones who really can stop something at a large scale level like that. So it's not quite so easy. And as for depleted uranium and all the after effects of war, while I'm in accord there, I think that this is a weapon of the Cold War that should be banned, should be included in the chemical and biological weapons bans. During the Kosovo campaign, it was also used, and it does have definitely damaging effects that way past the war itself. And agreed as well, you know, the Space Command out of Peterson does look like something out of, you know, Star Troopers or even maybe Stormtroopers. This idea of militarizing space is just absurd, and it does have to be confronted.
Hope that gets to the points of the caller. We're a little past our midpoint. Let me reintroduce our guest, and we'll continue on with another listener. And we're talking with James Derderian. And I'll spell his last name again because it's J-A-M-E-S-D-E-R-D-E-R-I-A-N, three words. And his book is Virtuous War, Mapping the Military-Industrial Media Entertainment Network, recently published by Westview Press. Professor Derderian teaches international relations at Brown University and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And we'll continue talking with callers. And if you'd like to join us, the number is 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Chicago next on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'm interested in the cost of the military situation. Back during the Cold War, during the first administration of the Georges, our military budget ran somewhere around $300 billion a year. This is with a 600-ship navy and a military that was supposed to be about 1 to 1.5 times, that is 2 to 2.5 times what it currently is, or, and so on. And yet the budget was running around $300 billion, and it never really came down more than about $40 billion in any one year, and it's now running somewhere around $325 billion and headed for $350 billion. At least that's the last I heard, according to some public statement made about a week or two ago. What would be a reasonable figure for the cost of the military budget at the present time? Do you have any figures on that?
Well, I think first you have to look at the process by which that budget's determined. It is one of the most bizarre, and in spite of repeated attempts, I don't know how many congressional commissions there have been. The big one now is called the Quadrennial Defense Review. Every 4 years, it's mandated that the Pentagon has to put together a study, you know, sort of saying, this is what the threat is, this is how much money it'll take to secure the United States against that threat. And then Secretary Rumsfeld comes in and does sort of an end-around play with these secret meetings behind closed doors, bringing in various folks. And it wasn't until really the Joint Chiefs and others complained that they were being frozen out as well that we saw a shift. And so I think the Quadrennial Defense Review is a tool that I think more Americans should be aware of, that it is open to public, I think, input as well as observation, participation, And there is a one way, I think, to fight sort of also this incredible boondoggling, horse trading, balkanizing process that goes on in the Congress. Then when, you know, they end up, you know, saying to the military, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, you come in under budget. We want, you know, to add, you know, $2 billion here, $3 billion there, $4 billion there, you know, for their own pet projects. And, you know, those billions add up. And instead of, you know, having any sort of decline after the Cold War, where there's supposed to be this peace dividend, we are now back up to Cold War spending levels. Even though, as the caller correctly points out, we've had, you know, shrinkage of troops, there is all these weapons systems programs that if you look at the sort of the curve, if you look at the, where they're going in terms of cost, some people have said, you know, by the year 2025, we'll be able to, meaning the Air Force will be able to afford one fighter bomber, you know, at this current rates. It has gotten out of hand. It's absurd, and it needs more public control at this point.
I want to return to your travel log and some of the things that you observed in this new sort of virtual war game environment that is, you know, increasingly used in training and preparing and thinking about the kinds of mission the military will be undertaking. There's a phrase you kept running into, and I want, maybe you could amplify on you know, the things that you saw that related to this. Everything but war is virtual. Did I get that right?
Yeah, all but war is virtual.
All but war is virtual.
Well, there's two different plays on it, but that's actually the slogan of one of the more interesting, I think, military bases I've ever gone to. It's a STRICOM I mentioned earlier. It stands for Simulation Training Instrumentation Command, which looks more like a research park down in Orlando. And, you know, you have all the defense industries and the military, you know, the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, all trying to create these virtual environments for training so that you'll be able to basically do real-time training and fighting. You know, they'll be practically simultaneous. That if you have like a terrorist attack somewhere in Colombia, you could use overhead surveillance, immediately project it back to these in virtual environments and have troops training and get them airborne within, you know, a day or two and be able to go in there and it'd be exactly like they had experienced. Well, when you say all but war simulation, you're really, first of all, putting, you know, making war sort of the reality principle, not peace for one. And also you're saying that that you want to create this almost invisible boundary now between simulation and war that I think is dangerous because people start to confuse one with the other. And as we know, no plan, you know, survives first contact with the enemy. You need things like history, intuition, you know, your gut. Also, you have to understand the power of fear and other motions that are always present on the battlefield. And simulations can't replicate that. And sometimes people start to confuse the simulation for the real thing. You know, they think the simulation is a better place to be. I'll go back there if I'm faced with cognitive dissonance, and that can have disastrous results.
Mm-hmm. So the kinds of simulation, can you sort of describe what this looks like?
Well, it varies. I mean, there's live simulations. Like when I would go out to the East Mojave Desert to observe these so-called digitized rotations where all these troops would be wired with computers and networked, that's in like an expanse of territory, you know, covering Rhode Island. You have heavy armor, you have F-16s, A-10s, Apaches, you know, the full works. This is full-scale war being simulated with lasers. Everybody has computer sensors that register if you're hit by one of these Miles lasers. Then you have constructed simulations and virtual simulations, which are more played out on computers. And the goal is to have all these networks, so you could have all three doing, you know, simulations at the same time, and you wouldn't be able to tell, is this an actual enemy, a virtual enemy, is this a computer-generated enemy, or someone out on the field pretending to be an enemy? It's one big network. That's the goal. And they brought in Hollywood to help them with some of the computer effects to help write the stories, and, you know, video gamers to help with the sort of technology of graphic design. It's all coming together now in a sort of new virtual alliance to sort of create the most real virtuality.
What's really interesting is, you know, obviously, you know, the military played a key role in developing computer technology to begin with, and the internet as well. and then sort of fell behind the private sector in developing simulation and, you know, virtual environments and so forth, and now is trying to catch up.
That's right.
By bringing in the people from Hollywood, as you say, and the Imagineers from Disney to help them construct these virtual environments.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when you look at the history of computing and networking from, you know, the early work being done in the Manhattan Project and also in, down at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, these were all generated by defense funds. And you had ARPANET, you know, for maintaining command and control of a nuclear network after an attack. But what happened is that the private sphere basically accelerated their technological development, and it became too expensive for the military to keep this big operations research going. So now the big thing is called commercial off-the-shelf, or COTS. They want to take what's available in Silicon Valley in Hollywood and, you know, apply it. And it's more cost-efficient, and they don't have as well these incredible lag times between the idea and the actual implementation.
We have a couple of the callers to include in our conversation. Let's do that. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you. This is a wonderful topic, something that's not often discussed, and especially the economics of warfare are not very often discussed. What I find interesting is I remember it was about 10 years ago, Gwyn Dyer did a documentary series on war, and in that he pointed out the fact that an F-15, 14, I can't remember, at that time took approximately 16 months to assemble. And what a vulnerable position that puts you in a modern warfare. And that's something I think people don't really think about, that when you're talking about these very advanced tanks, I mean, sure, we have 50 bazillion, you know, cruise missiles lying around, but they're not exactly intelligent. You know, if we got into a serious, real conflict against an opponent who had weapons, you know, capable of destroying our weapons, we'd be in serious trouble. We could not replace our weaponry as quickly as it would be used. And I think that's something in particular people need to look at in the space field. The putting armaments in space is just ridiculous. When a 50-cent ball bearing fired by a slingshot can destroy your, you know, $30 billion weapon, I mean, it is just, you know, really ridiculous to even consider warfare. And that's something I think people don't realize, that a real shooting war would damage our military capability very seriously. So thank you, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for the call.
Well, the caller, I mean, much of the analysis is sound, but it's based on, I think, in some ways a faulty assumption that there is an enemy that's willing to take on the United States, you know, toe-to-toe. The idea now is that if there's going to be a threat, it's going to be an asymmetrical threat, mm-hmm. language they use in the Pentagon, that we saw a glimpse of in what happened in Mogadishu when, you know, the most technologically advanced, you know, Ranger outfit gets taken down by, you know, relatively primitive RPGs, these basically bazookas and AK-47s, and using primitive technologies rather than like cell phones, which can be traced, they muster civilians and other sort of street fighters, and ended up, you know, 18 dead in the streets of Mogadishu. That's what they're worried about, asymmetrical warfare, and they're replacing equipment. I think will be an issue when you're talking about that equivalent of that ball bearing taking out a satellite, would be if you do lose an Apache helicopter or a Black Hawk helicopter to a very inexpensive, handheld, small weapon, then you are at risk. So I think that, and the other way around, you know, you use a cruise missile, you know, with the latest GPS running close to $1 million, to take out the headquarters of bin Laden, for instance, in Afghanistan. You know, you use like 50 of these things, and what do? You destroy a couple tin shacks, and you kill more sheep than you do, you know, terrorists. There, the cost-benefit analysis is clearly a little wacky.
We have a couple, actually, several callers waiting, and I want to get right into them. But there is one issue that you raise in the book that I think, you know, is important for us to try to talk a little bit about. as, you know, and you sort of alluded to the lack of a suitable enemy for the United States or anything on the level of the past opponents in the military sphere. And the way this virtual technology is imagining who our future opponents will be may actually help create the scenarios that we're preparing for.
Right. This is what I've referred to as almost a simulation sickness. It's a play on the idea of when you use these simulators, people aren't allowed to like fly for 48 hours because they have trouble, what's called Q conflict, between what's real and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, I think that, you know, if you're running all these scenarios, it's what you can't imagine that's going to, you know, basically hit you over the head in the next conflict. It's the fact that none of these scenarios can be completely sort of holistic, and yet there's sort of this almost arrogance that they are sort of preparing us for the future. And it's, you know, on one hand, it's great. You know, it's important to have this training so you don't go out and make stupid mistakes. I don't deny that value. But it's when you start to mistake the simulation and the simulated enemy as, you know, the total reality that then all kinds of new hazards and dangers start to pop up.
Well, let's continue talking with some more callers. We have just about maybe 6 or 7 minutes left, and we'll get as many people as we can. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. I was just wondering if your guest had read the report, Opportunities in Biotechnology for Future Army Applications, by the National Research Council's Board on Army Science and Technology. It just came out 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Have you?
I haven't had a chance. I've been involved in some of these issues previously, but I certainly haven't seen that piece. I'd be interested in its contents.
Yeah, I can't. I can't really describe it very much, except they've got rather, you know, like for example, they talk about. I haven't read it myself. I'm looking at press reports, and they talk about things like high-capacity computer memories based on proteins to be carried by individual soldiers, wound healing technologies. But I guess my real question was, most of what you've talked about didn't have very much to do with biotechnology, and I think there's a lot going on in that area. I was just wondering if you'd run into very much of it.
Oh, well, I do look into this whole idea of sort of what I call, playing on Donna Haraway's work, the cyborgization of the, you know, the soldier, the idea that increasingly you're using all kind of prosthetics to make the human a more efficient killing machine, you know, literally, to the extent that it's dehumanizing and even perhaps at one level, you know, the logic is you're leading to robotics. But the biological element is it's fascinating because I think that's where some of the most interesting, if not you know, scary research is going on in nanotechnology, but also, as you mentioned, where, you know, gradually you're going to be implanting everything from sensors to, you know, stimulations that are going to enhance the soldier, but at the same time perhaps lead to this idea or this sort of cyborg identity where you have to wonder, you know, what is there sort of a human element to war anymore? What does that mean? That's one of the questions I raise in the book.
Thanks
very much for the call. We'll go next to a listener on line number two on a cell phone in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. I was just going to point out that what was a previous caller mentioned this, the issue of that it takes 16 months to build an F-15. That is not remotely unusual in the history of modern warfare. Almost all weapons that are built in peacetime take far, far, far too long to build. This happened in the 1930s. it happened before World War I. It's every time. And it's also not unusual that peacetime training, particularly after many years of no conflict, starts to become quite unrealistic. For instance, at the beginning of World War II, an enormous number of field and general officers were relieved of command because while they were suitable for peacetime command, once they actually got in the field, they couldn't do the job. I don't think there's any reason to expect that if we had a large conflict, the similar thing would not happen. And the same thing goes true with nearly any weapon. Every weapon that's built is too expensive, too complicated for wartime use, always. And they always simplify them, every time. I mean, no, they may develop technologically in other ways, but they're always designed to be mass-produced. And the stuff that's built during peacetime is never designed to be mass-produced. So I don't know that when if we were to look at the numbers to say, oh, well, we produce an F-15 every 16 months, you know, first of all, that's at peacetime production level, which isn't all that quick.
Yeah.
And, you know, so just historically, this is not an unusual pattern.
Okay.
And I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Well, just for the sake of brevity, I would say that's usually the case. But when you use words like mass produce, we're really talking about the industrial model. And I think we're moving out of the industrial model into an informational one. And then that means that, you know, just as you wouldn't want to lose massive number of soldiers with massive number of weapons, there's a premium on not losing those weapons and not losing those soldiers that changes the nature of warfare itself.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I'm sorry there's one caller we won't be able to take, but I want to sort of ask you to talk about the role of the media in all this, because we haven't really had a chance to do that much. There was one point in the book where you're discussing the Bosnian War, and I think this is an illustration of how important television has become to the military. They almost view it as something that is part of the war fighting process, or at least a major determinant of what's going to happen. I believe that most of the people, there's one meeting you're describing where everyone seemed to believe that whatever happened in Bosnia, it would be determined, at least to some extent, by television.
Oh, definitely, because you need, for all the obvious reasons, you need to convince public opinion this war is winnable, there's an exit strategy. You have, like, now the technology and the media that allows all these people to what I call globally swarm. It's a form of global swarming, all of the CNN, the Fox, all the cable networks, to present in real time what's going on with pretty good accuracy. And it means that the military now is geared up for another war, media wars. Their public affairs officers are incredibly well-trained, and that used to be a dead end, basically, for any kind of military career. Now it's a much pursued one, and you have very sophisticated folks out there presenting the case, and it's almost like another front of any wars is what's going to be put on the screen, how it's going to be edited, and the most important thing is the images. You know, people have often noted that it's that first image that sticks, and not so much the text or context or the after image. It's whoever gets that first image up first and presents it to the American public is going to sway public opinion.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop since we're out of time, and we successfully scratched the surface of the book, but if you'd like to read more, you can look for it. It is entitled Virtuous War, Mapping the Military-Industrial Media Entertainment Network, recently published by Westview Press, and the author has been our guest, James Derderian, and again, his last name is D-E-R-D-E-R-I-A-N, and Professor Derderian, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I greatly enjoyed it.